Hello, this is Michael Moody, and you are listening to the Elements of Being podcast, where I explore what it means to live the life you want with people who do just that, whether they are filmmakers, writers, industry icons, or otherwise. Today, you'll hear an inspiring conversation with a champion of social justice, Jamal Kolb. His mission is to build a more interconnected Chicago, the pillars of service and education. And this was, without a doubt, reflected in our time together. As the founder and CEO of the city's fastest-growing social impact organization, My Block, My Hood, My City, Jamal is the creator of an exposure-based education program for teens and a network of volunteer initiatives that serve Chicago communities year-round. Traveling, youth mentorship, and community organizing are the subjects of Jamal's highly acclaimed books and speeches. He has spoken to audiences ranging from high school students to the mayor of Chicago. Jamal is most recently the recipient of the 2019 Champion of Freedom Award from Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the 2018 Chicago Defender Men of Excellence honoree, and the 2018 Chicago City Council Resolution Award. And it doesn't stop. In 2018, he was also named one of the 20 most inspiring Chicagoans by Streetwise magazine and a Chicagoan of the Year by Chicago Magazine. In this episode, we'll examine how to stir community spirit, starting with small gestures, look for inspiration from Uber bumper stickers of all places, establish a tent in your life, remove yourself from the destructive traps of justification, and take responsibility for your conditions and environment. So with this being said, let's jump in. Jamal, thank you for sharing the table with me.
Hey, thanks for having me here, man. Don't get to this side of town often, so it's good to be out here.
Great, great. And you walked quite a distance to be with us today.
Oh, man. I think something's going on Michigan Avenue where they have like a sniper test on the water tower or something. So the traffic is just really bad. So this morning I've been in an Uber for an hour already. Spilled coffee in the Uber. So I gave her $100 just to clean her back seat. I was so upset and embarrassed. But jeez. Anyway, yeah, it's been a long morning already, but glad to be here.
Well, I want to share a little bit about you. You've been well recognized. You are the recipient of the 2019 Champion of Freedom Award from former Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the 2018 Chicago Defender Men of Excellence honoree, and the 2018 Chicago City Council Resolution Award recipient. And then in 2018, you were also named one of the 20 most inspiring Chicagoans by Streetwise magazine, also a Chicagoan of the Year by Chicago Magazine. I think the only thing that's missing is perhaps maybe a spot on The Bachelor. But you are married and you have a couple kids.
I'm married. But no, then there's the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, there's the 40 Under 40 Award, the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. There's all these things out there. But anyway, my wife don't even let me hang awards up no more. So it's like going to a box. I keep them for my daughter. She got tired of seeing them, so she just took them down.
That's great. Well, well-deserved and simply incredible. Thank you for bringing a new vision of hope and community to our blocks, our neighborhood, and our city. So clearly, you're well-recognized for your organization and your efforts. What is one thing about you that most people don't know?
I don't know what I'm doing most times. And as a leader, I think that's it's kind of, you being vulnerable when you share that, but I really don't. People look up to me and they say, man, like you know where you're doing. You know, you're successful, you're getting these awards, you're getting this money, you're making change happen. But honestly, I think leadership is about not about knowing, it's about asking questions, seeking to understand, and then being comfortable with uncertainty and moving forward still. I think that's what, when I go into communities, I don't know what I'm doing. I just say, hey, how can I help? When I go into schools, I don't know what I'm doing. I say, hey, how can I get involved? When I go into Cook County Jail, I don't know. I'm scared sometimes, but I say, how can I help guys? And from there, God gives me the instincts to help. And that's what I'm good at.
Yeah. How do you think you could instill that in other people? Because that seems to be a defining characteristic of many leaders.
Yeah. I think you just have to be able to step outside your comfort zone and not, you can't be in the snare of preparation too much. You know what I mean? Mm. You have to learn from the firing line of experience and just be comfortable with messing up. You know what I mean? As a leader, it's like being on a bike. You know, when you get on a bike, you're going to fall, you know, but it's just when you're a leader, it's public. But you just got to be okay to say, hey, I'm going to just take it with a grain of salt, because ain't nobody thinking about you anyway. They're thinking about themselves. So.
Sure, sure. And I think a lot of people, as they take those steps towards greater leadership, there's always a pivotal point where just something flips. I'm sure you, like everyone else, has experienced a number of failures in taking these steps on this path. So can you describe a specific instance where maybe it just clicked? Something happened.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I've even reached a point where things have just clicked. I would just say that I've reached a point where the road is too narrow for me to turn around. You know, it's like it's too tight. You know, I've already come this far, and I try to stand guard at the door of my thoughts. So I try to only take in good stuff. So I try to read things about stories of success and stories of leadership. Coach Nagy for the Bears told me to read a book called The Captain Class. Mm. And it's about how the most winningest teams in the history of the world, I don't care if it was a high school volleyball team, if they won 5 straight championships, this author studied how they did it. And so I try to stay feeding my mind with positive influences, and I don't take the negativity in. And that solves like at least 60% of the battle for me.
What? How do you restrict that? That seems to be a great challenge for most, especially with media, magazines, movies, banter around us. So how do you filter that?
It's really hard. Every day is another struggle at it. And I feel like I try to limit my followers on Twitter and Instagram so I can only be following positive people. Unfortunately, the only thing that really makes me happy is like gangster rap, like the worst kind. It like for some reason brings out like if I'm in a bad mood, like listening to the for some reason I can't explain it, but those stories of like just coming from the streets make me happy. And I have to work that out sometimes, like, Jamal, why does this make you happy? But it's how I came up. So man, it's a struggle, but I've just realized when it comes to when you actually realize that self-discipline is the key, once you get a little taste of success, the early rewards will be so great, you'll continue on. So it's like, man, that you have to have discipline for everything.
Sure, sure. Well, let's get back to what you just mentioned about rap, because you have mentioned before that the rapper Nas had a great influence on you at the age of 4. You rap?
Of course. Every like month when I'm really depressed, I'll make a rap.
Interesting. What's that writing session like? A little bit different from writing a book, or the same?
The same. All my books start off as raps. Okay. Yeah. So my new book is going to be started off as a rap. But no, it's not really even writing. It's just telling the truth. So when I'm, it's therapeutic. Like when you grow up in a hood, you don't have no counselor. So making a rap is like making a contribution. And it's like you got so much PTSD that you need to let it off. So when I rapped, it was really like my rap name was Books. Everybody called me Books because I told stories. And so I just be like, you know, my mom say my dad doing drugs, I ain't believer. Sister say my mom. No, so I messed it up. So I say my mom say my dad's doing dope, I ain't believer. Sister say my dad's doing dope, I ain't believer. My friends say my dad's smoking crack. I said, how'd you know? He said, yesterday I sold him some blow. So my mom say my dad's smoking crack, I ain't believer. Sister say my pot smoking crack, I ain't believer. My friends say my pot smoking crack. I said, how'd you know? He said, yesterday I sold him some blow. So this is like a really like a when you hear your parents telling your other dad your dad's doing drugs, you don't know how to process that at like 13, 12 years old. You know, you 11 years old. You don't know why you're homeless, why you're sleeping here, but your mom is like, your dad ain't nothing, he doing drugs. And so I was scared a lot of nights when I was homeless, but when I rapped about it, my friends thought I was legendary. It gave me, it's like, oh man, you real. We can connect to that. So it was like automatically I found it. And I learned how to do that because Nas shared stories about his, you know, broken bottles in the hallways and blood-stained floors and just mom should have cuffed me to the radiator. I was like, what? I was like, you can make a contribution in the world by just telling the truth?
Yeah.
Oh man, it was therapeutic from that day on.
Yeah, I bet. And I think a lot of people could relate to that across various genres of music, right? Because it is an expression. And it is interesting that you compared it to writing a book. In fact, I mean, you said that's how you start your books. Because mm-hmm. I would almost think it would be two different processes. What do you have to do to set up this process? Is there an ideal location, environment, music, feeling?
For the rap or the book?
Both.
Well, for the book, it's kind of just like a longer rap. So you need to set yourself up for success by putting yourself in places where you'll be inspired to write every day. I don't care if it's one paragraph or 10 pages, you need to write every day. And I go to a lot of coffee shops in Inglewood, you know, South Shore, around the city. If I'm writing about excuses, I'll go to the currency exchanges or the Western Unions and hear people talking on the phone, because that's where you'll get the most. I try to plagiarize life. I try to write as real as possible about what's actually happening. I'll write a paragraph about a smell, a sound, the chain link fence, something. Also, I don't want to see the cover of my book until I'm about 1 month from being done, because that'll push you to finish it. I don't want to think about marketing until I'm actually done with the book, because that'll just, you know, it's two different things. As far as the raps go, man, that's just like, I just write about what I see. So my new book is called It's Not Regular. And it's basically about the reason I called it It's Not Regular instead of the new normal was because there's a church on Garfield and State Street called the New Philadelphia, and Philadelphia rhyme with regular. So that's kind of how I like made it. But no, there's a church and then there's a liquor store across the street from the church. There's a KFC with bulletproof glass windows right across from that. There's a Western Union right across from that. So as I was driving down the street, I said, I pass a New Philadelphia and pray that God is helping us. Cash my check at the Western Union like it's regular. Order food through the bulletproof like it's regular. German Shepherd sniff me on a train like it's regular. Blue lights flashing on them poles like it's regular. Red X's boarded up homes, dang regular. Shot spotters sit on top of poles like it's regular. Dead people still cast on votes like it's regular. Garrett's popcorn line long like it's regular. Welfare line long everywhere, that's every month. Ain't nobody in a line of votes though, that's regular. Same alderman for 20 years like it's regular. Cop shot him 16 times like it's regular. He ain't even getting no jail time, dang regular. Every month another mass shooting getting deadlier. Passing by the church, I always pray that God is helping us. And so that's kind of how I just took that scene and painted it into a book, basically.
You make it sound so simple. That was incredible. But think about what you're telling us and what we were talking about earlier, just bringing a new awareness to what's happening, not only in the neighborhoods that perhaps you've grown up in or that you now live in, but also sharing that with the world. Music for me and my wife is a big part of our life. And of course, it steers, you know, the stream of consciousness for myself as well. What other musicians and artists do you listen to that have really inspired you in your writing?
Cody Chestnut, he was a acoustic guitar player. Jack Johnson, you know, he's a acoustic guitar player from Hawaii. I want to play my goal in life is to retire and start a farm and learn how to play acoustic guitar. I love the acoustic guitar very, very much. I like Nas, Mos Def. Kanye West album called College Dropout actually inspired me to graduate college, so go figure. I like old school artists like Gil Scott-Heron. You know, it's just really too many. I listen to anybody if they're writing about some real stuff that I can relate to, and I'm a sucker for melodies too.
You probably have picked up some of my Chicago accent, especially when I was mentioning Nas's name. I think I said Nas. You'll have to excuse that, of course. Born and raised in Chicago.
That's all good.
But that is a part of me. And but I certainly have a invested interest in your contribution.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned before, what you do in your neighborhood also affects me on the north side. It affects everyone. And Chicago is my home. And my wife and I had started our own grassroots effort to build a strong, positive community through our neighborhood organization, the Racine Triangle Association. I'm undoubtedly intrigued by your story, especially knowing that you went from being a software administrator to now the CEO of your foundation, My Block, My Hood, My City. Describe the day you made this decision. What fears and insecurities ran through your head? Did you imagine the organization would reach this height?
Well, I was never going to work in technology. I'm a self-published author, and I was selling my books downtown in front of Foot Locker for $10 a pop. I was poor, man. I was just taking money from my daughter's piggy bank just to get downtown. And if I didn't sell a book, I couldn't even get back out south because that's how poor I was. You know, Christmas time 2009, maybe, one of my friends that mowed lawns for a rich guy on the north side was like, hey, Jamal, I know a business owner that's moving offices. He needs help moving boxes. Will you, you know, he's going to pay us $100 a day. Will you show up? It probably took a week. You know, every time I showed up to move boxes for the trading firm, this little Chinese guy, I know he's Japanese, he used to show up and say, hey, why are you always early and your friends are always late? And I was like, well, my college basketball coach always told me that if you were on time, that was late. You know, you always want to be early. You always want to do more than people expect. So after about a week of working, lifting boxes, he showed up one day. I was like, follow me. And there was like all these white guys around a round table or a long table. And they were like, Jamal, what do you know about networking? And I was like, you mean like Facebook? I was like, what are you guys talking about? He was like, no, we mean like, you know, Cisco networking, like Microsoft engineering. I was like, they're like, hey, if we put you in school for Microsoft engineering, could you pass? And I was like, well, you know, I made straight A's in college. You know, I could, my best quality is my attitude and work ethic. So boom, they wrote me like an $8,000 check to go to MicroTrain for 2 months. And I went to MicroTrain, failed miserably. Hmm. I came back like, guys, I'm sorry. This was the hardest stuff in my life. I couldn't do it. You know, right when I was talking, boop, $8,000 check, go try it again. I went and took it again, did some better stuff, had some flashcards, still failed by 6 points. Came back 2 months. They were like, what could you do better? I was like, well, I'm 6 points away from passing. Wrote me another $8,000 check. And a third time I passed. And once I got my Microsoft administration certificate, they hired me on at the trading firm. And I worked there for 4 years. So I was already an activist in self-publishing books and volunteering while I was at the firm. I never, when kids would get out of jail, I'd bring them to the firm, you know, to show them how easy it was to build operating systems. To me, I always wanted to be, you know, a politician or activist. And I felt like at the trading firm, that was like a fish out of water experience for me to challenge myself and work around guys from Harvard and Princeton and the best universities and see what I could learn from them. It was like a good incubator. And they trusted me for some reason. You know, it was weird when the CEO gives you the key to his house the first day of work and says, hey, you know, I need you to go. Here's the keys to my house. Everybody's house on the block is open. We need you to connect the networks to these homes. You got to go to Sea Caucus, New Jersey next week to get these servers. You know, they just put all this trust in me. It was weird. I never felt like, why are these guys doing that to me? But it was a great space for me. And I was able to grow in that environment.
So many questions. Getting back to failing the tests or the program several times, why didn't you walk away?
Because at the trading firm was exciting for me. It was challenging and I wanted to be like those guys. I wanted to be successful. I wanted to be smart, or what I thought was perceived to be smart. You know, I don't know. I just wanted to, you know, I thought it was cool. Oh, you're a Microsoft. I love saying that. You're a Microsoft engineer. Yeah, I'm going to be a Microsoft engineer. I work at a trading firm. I felt like it was, you know, when you say that to people say, oh, wow, you got a good job, you know? And so I felt like, oh, wow, I have an opportunity here and I want to make the most of it. And that's why I kept pushing forward.
And what do you think that passion for activism stemmed from?
Yeah, I know that like the back of my hand. We, the class of 1988, are determined to be our best at whatever we say or do. We'll share a smile and lend a hand to our neighbor, because no matter what, we'll be the best in a lifetime. So those 50 words are that's the entirety of my preschool graduation speech. And like, you know, I gave that speech when I was 4 years old. You know, even my dad, all he played, he didn't play music a lot. He played Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, Stokely Carmichael, Booker T. Washington. Like, I grew up in a household where I got teased for wearing suits to school every day. You see what I'm saying? Like, I was always going to be, my dad told me I'd be a senator since I was six, you know? So I grew up in a household that, even though my dad, you know, he'd be rolling weed up right in front of me, he said, you know, I don't ever want you doing drugs, son. Even though everybody in my household either went to jail for 40 years or 80 years, like, I was always, those were my role models, and they always pushed me towards going to college and doing something great, because my dad always said to everybody that I was going to be, you know, a senator, I was going to be a mayor, I was going to be something like that. So everybody always assumed that that's what I would do.
Yeah, but it's interesting. If we look at the flip of that, people will remark, actions speak louder than words. And yeah. many people fall into, or at least latch onto, what they see and what you mentioned about your dad and your cousins. What do you think separates you from a lot of people who end up following that same path?
I think I was scared. You know, I think I was always like scared. My mom had me go to church 3 times a week, and I think I developed a conscience. At least that's what I was teased for. My dad was, oh, you got a conscience. Ain't no right or wrong. You know, I mean, ain't no such thing as marriage. Ain't no such thing as this. You know, my dad was just always in my ear about that stuff. Ain't no such thing as Christianity. You know, like my dad. In fact, the only reason he let me go to church was so I wouldn't be afraid to talk to white people. That's why he told me, I don't want you to be afraid to talk to white people. That's the only reason he let me go to church. But no, I think what kept me from doing it is that I thought people that sold drugs was dirty. I didn't like people that did drugs. I was like, man, y'all standing in front of the basketball court for 8 hours. I'd rather play basketball. These dudes is dirty that's walking up to y'all. And it was scary. And I didn't like fighting. You know, I didn't like doing nothing like that. So I'd rather play basketball because I thought it was fun. Yeah.
Your mission is to expose Chicago youth to places and opportunities outside of their neighborhoods, places they may not have otherwise known existed. And you grew up in an impoverished, high crime neighborhood on the South Side.
No. I didn't grow up in Chicago. I grew up in an impoverished neighborhood called Waukegan, Illinois. It's North Chicago and Waukegan are like connected. So, you know, my dad was in the Navy and my mom's from the west side of Chicago. But you know, my whole family, you know, a lot of families from the west side. But I grew up in Waukegan. It's still under resourced. It's more isolated than I would say Chicago. There's no CTAs. There's no, you know, it's not a lot of happening. So there's a lot of narrow mindedness out there. Yeah, I always say poverty of imagination is what we suffered from a lot. Yeah.
So how did you as a kid know that there was more outside of your own neighborhood in Waukegan?
Because my parents would break up, and my dad is originally from Texas. So every time they would break up, my mom would ship me at like 9 years old on the Greyhound bus by myself, crying over summer. And she would send me to stay with my dad in Fort Worth, Texas. As we came from Waukegan to Chicago, you know, we stop at the station. But then we stop at the, you know, I see the cornfields of Greater Illinois. I'd see, I'd get to Memphis and see the river, the different accents, the foods, the scenery. I just became mesmerized with the country. Seeing life through those Greyhound bus windows really gave me an advantage over my friends, because when it came time to go to college, nobody had ever left Waukegan. Nobody ever left North Chicago. My advantage, like, I never took a vacation growing up. I never went to Disneyland, but every time my parents broke up, those Greyhound bus trips was my vacation. So that was my secret. That's the only thing that I relied upon, was just knowing that, hey man, you've been on a bus before for a day and a half. You know the sun's gonna rise the next day. You can do it. And that's kind of what gave me the confidence to step outside my comfort zone and go to college in Nebraska.
You know, I think about parenting and many of the challenges that kids face, and we always encourage new experiences without a doubt. It appeals to curiosity. It's part of their learning process as they grow older. But what we're finding is it's more than just the new experiences that they need. Usually it's the guidance that comes along with it, because you just don't know how they're going to receive their environment. Mm-hmm. You don't know how they're going to interact with it. You've been to a number of different environments, as you just described. Were there any specific mentors or role models that help you make sense of these experiences that you've had?
Yeah, I would say it was my dad's lofty expectations he had on me. You know, he always told me I was going to either go to the NBA or be a senator. So I automatically imagined myself as, I didn't even think of life without graduating college, because we never talked about it. We always talked about once I got my master's degree, once I graduated college. But no, I was very unprepared. Like, listening to my pops telling me I was going to go to the NBA and then driving to college in Nebraska, walking on the basketball team, Lord of mercy, man. I was very underprepared. I didn't have a left hand. I was out of shape. I wasn't a great shooter. I never was used to playing with referees. I was athletic, but I didn't know how to think and play basketball. I was very behind. I was persistent, and I had a good work ethic and a good attitude. So this coach let me walk on the basketball team. After about one semester, he said, "Jamal, why do you have a 1.7 GPA? You know, your work ethic's good. People like you. I don't understand why your grades are so low." And his name was Rico Burkett. I was like, "Hey, since you let me walk on the team, I'm gonna tell you the truth. I don't have any books. You know, I've never even read a book in my life. I definitely can't afford these books. Plus, I went to an alternative high school, so I'm not used to having teachers, let alone professors. Plus, I'm missing classes because of our games, coach. You know, I'm missing class because of games." And I said, plus people in Nebraska are racist. Somebody on my own team called me colored. I told him it's cold out here. I don't got no money. I hate the food. It smells like manure. People treat me bad. And I was like, "Coach, I'm having a hard time adjusting." And my coach, he was like, "Jamal, you know what's missing from your list?" I was like, "No, what?" He's like, "Your name's not on it." He's like, "No excuses. The highest level of maturity is taking full responsibility for your actions." I was like, "This dude is crazy." I was like, "What do you mean no excuses? I just told you that it's cold out here. I don't got no money. I hate the food. It smells. After your long practices, I got to get back to my dorm room and roll some dice, watch some MTV. I don't got time to be studying and reading. I don't have no books. What do you mean no excuses? I've never had a teacher before. I'm from Chicago. You know, what are you talking about? Like, you know, this is crazy." And he was like, "No excuses. The highest level of maturity is taking full responsibility for your actions." So anyway, long story long, man, I come back in 2 days. You know, he gives me a book scholarship for $500. You know, I'm elated. I'm going to the league. Now I'm like, I'm rich. I can buy my books, get some shoes. I bought 4 of the 5 books I needed. In one semester, I went from a 1.7 to a 3.5. I had 4 A's and 1 C. And so I was ecstatic. I went back to my coach 6 months later. I said, "You got to play me now. I'm going to the NBA. You ain't been playing me because you said I had bad grades. You said no, all the no excuses stuff. I got 4 A's and a 1 C. What can you tell me now? You can't say nothing. Boom, check it out. My coach Rico, he looked at me. He looked at my report card. Looked at me, looked at my report card. He said, Jamal. I said, what? He said, why the hell did you get a C? I said, why did I get a C? I just told you I went to alternative high school. I just told you I've never had teachers, let alone professors. It's cold out here. I've got no money. I hate the food. He said, Jamal, no excuses. The highest level of maturity is taking full responsibility for your actions. So I never played basketball in college. I played 5 minutes in 4 years. I hated Rico. Like, I was supposed to go to the league and buy everybody Cadillacs on my block. I hated my coach. I hated him with the passion. I didn't talk to him. I made such good grades that I graduated college a year early, but I hated this dude. I hated him until, you know, I wrote a book, my first book. I wrote about this experience going from an alternative high school to college in Nebraska. And I was selling these books downtown in front of Foot Locker. Somebody from Cook County Jail read the book and said, Jamal, this is inspiring stuff. Come talk to the 18-year-olds at the jail. And then when I got to the jail, they said, no, not 18-year-olds. We said AT. That's an acronym for automatic transfer. These teenagers are going downstate for murder. Will you still talk to them? And the kids didn't want to hear me talk. So I just started asking questions. I was like, Marquell, why hasn't your life worked out up until right now? And Marquell was like, it's cold out here. I don't got no money. I hate the food. It smells like me. I was like, what? I was like, that's my list of excuses I gave Rico. And that's when it dawned on me. That's when my click moment happened. I was like, man, all this time I was in college, Rico wasn't even teaching me basketball. He wasn't teaching me to change my jump shot. He wanted me to change my philosophy. Because back in 2001, I blamed everybody for my problems. The teachers messed up. The school's messed up. The system is messed up. Everybody, my philosophy is messed up. And so right then, I knew my charge in life. When I heard Marquell making them comments, right then, I knew this ain't even what I wanted to do in life. It was what God was calling me on it. I was like, I remember when I thought like you. I remember when I made those same excuses. And that's the same thing I see in Chicago now, man. You ask somebody, why does your block look like this? They say the city's messed up, the weather's messed up, the governing philosophy is messed up.
In every neighborhood, every community.
Yeah. What could you do to make your block better? Like, what's something simple you could do to change everything? That gives you power. Then John F. Kennedy said, ask not what the government can do for you, but what can you do for the government? So you should ask not what Lori Lightfoot could do for you. What could you help Lori Lightfoot? Like, democracy starts from a block level. What's something simple you can do to change everything? And that's, you don't have the muscles it takes to handle the big challenges unless you can organize your block. Come on now.
Yeah. One aspect of your organization is the youth-led community explorations. And so without a doubt, you are creating leadership opportunities for many of these teens in these communities. And I'm curious, when you were a teen, did you have any of these opportunities as well? Did you engage or...
No. I just broke into houses. Like I didn't, my fun was like breaking into houses, rapping, breaking into cars at Walmart. You know, I didn't really have that was fun. That was our fun. You know what I mean? I wouldn't even think we were bad people. It's just that it was what we did, play basketball, break into houses. If I broke in a house and stole something, it'd be a camcorder because I cared about technology. I'd run right home and say, Dad, look what I got. I stole a camcorder out the house. My dad wouldn't be like, he wouldn't be mad at me for breaking into a house. He'd be mad if I did it with people. Like, man, you broke into a house with those people? You know, I told you, like, you don't want to do stuff with other people. Do it by yourself. And So my role models were drug dealers. And like I say, those were my role models growing up. So no, I didn't have I didn't have a frame of reference even until I was after college.
So as you're saying this, I'm just thinking about some of the things that have occurred in our neighborhood, including armed carjacking, a couple of muggings, trespassing. We do have cars that are broken into. As I mentioned, it seems like for most people, everything is a reaction. Okay, so let's build a wall to make sure this doesn't happen again. But we know that there is something a little bit deeper. If you truly want change, it's got to start with the root of the problem. And it isn't so much that we imprison or build that wall, perhaps to change that stream of consciousness that we talk about. But what's interesting, just based on the story you just described it, that would seem like a very difficult feat because you're describing what you would do at one point as a form of enjoyment. I've rationalized in the back of my mind that maybe part of that reason has been lack of resources or, you know, it's just an immediate need. But maybe you could kind of share a little more of the psychology, at least for you, but then also for other people that have also engaged in a lot of the same behaviors, just to gain a better understanding.
Your role models, the guys that you want to be like, are doing it. So only way you can feel cool and like you're a part of something is to do it and talk about it. So and rap about it. And so it's, you're almost a punk if you ain't doing it. Like, you know, going to school all day. Like if I went to school for 2 weeks, my dad would be like, you've been going to school a lot. You going to school again today? That you went 2 weeks already. Like I didn't have parents reinforcing things. When I said I wanted to go to college, my mom told me I was trying to be white. When I told my friends I wanted to go to college, I got beat up and got my jaw broke. You know what I mean? Like there was no, like I had nobody reinforcing that stuff. So the only way I could feel like I was cool was to rap about, you know, we came up with nothing. Heat the house of the oven. Nothing up in the refrigerator, was born to be hustling. Like that's how I grew up. So yeah, man, it wasn't, and it never really was fun to like, to say, oh, we're going to go break into some cars tonight. It was all just like, we had nobody showing us there was anything else to do. You know what I mean? There was nobody saying, hey, you guys could have this internship. You know, you guys could be doing this. You could do that. We had like idle time as the devil's workshop or playground, whatever. And we had a lot of idle time.
And certainly you're making a change with the organization, which I do want to talk more about it in terms of helping these teens experience a little something beyond what they know within this cycle or what's being exhibited or modeled within their environment. You've been quoted as saying, I just think people don't feel connected to the city. They just feel like they're comfortable in their isolated community of Lincoln Park or they're under a resource community in Roseland. And both of those people, if you have that limited mindset, that's what's holding our city back. This is truly a challenge that my wife and I have noticed in our community as well. I mean, putting aside a lack of resources, it seems people too easily and understandably get lost in the demands of their job, who get sucked into their devices. And not surprising, most people park their car and run inside, rarely acknowledging their neighbors and their environment. What do you think, outside of the neighborhoods that you typically work with, what steps should people take to reconnect with their neighborhoods in the city?
The more connected you are, the safer you are, the healthier you are, the happier you are. That's a fact. And I'm just not just talking Facebook. I'm talking physically connected with people. I don't care if you call it a block club, a neighborhood group, a residence association, a homeowner. If there's 16 houses on one side of the street and 19 houses on the other side of the street, just say hi to one of your neighbor. If everybody said hi to their neighbor, the city would be better instantly. I feel like our philosophy is what's something simple you can do to make a positive impact in your block, and that'll create a ripple impact or effect in a city. So I feel like, what can you do? Boom. You could come home and you could like just see somebody in your block and say hello and say, hey, my name is XYZ. You know, this is what I do. What kind of work do you do? You know, and just because you guys made that connection, your block automatically becomes a lot better. And you don't have to walk around with a clipboard or an iPad in your hand to do it. This is not community organizing. This is just being a good neighbor. You know what I mean? I think once people make an effort to be a good neighbor, your connections get better and the universe rewards that.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to be persistent, right? I know when I first moved back to the city after college, a friend of mine remarked, you know, don't be surprised if you're walking down the street and you randomly say hi to someone that they're not going to respond. Mm-hmm. And being bright-eyed, I didn't think that would be possible. Yeah. And enthusiastically would still say hello to people. But most of the time, people might turn away or, you know, slightly acknowledge. That is a great example of that lack of connection. And you don't necessarily have to know the person well, but it's just this extension of you in one way or another. And that often is blocked, perhaps for their own personal reasons. But I have found, even within this community, sometimes you have to build that trust. And so it takes repeated smiles, mm-hmm, or a repetition of gestures, and so that they can trust you and know that there's someone, that you are someone that they connect with. But that's difficult to do.
Yeah, I mean, create a template for a flyer and put it in everybody's mailbox twice a month and say you're having a block club or a meeting in the backyard or at the local coffee shop, and maybe one person will come, appreciate that one person, get their email, maybe put them in a Facebook group, and then have another one the next month, and then maybe two people will come. But you got to do the physical flyering, and you got to have a way to capture their contact information once they get there. Because that's, once you start asking questions about, hey, how can we improve the quality of life on this block? They'll be like, oh, you know what? we need a stop sign. There's too many people, you know, too many cars speeding. Now, well, how many signatures does it take to get a stop sign? Okay, now we're on to something. Well, you might need a speed bump in the alley. Oh, we don't want the old plastic speed bumps. We want the concrete speed bump. How do you go about getting that? How do I advocate for that? We don't like the fluorescent street lights. We want the old school street lights. These new LED ones don't work. They're not bright enough. Well, how do we go about getting that? I think it's just about, if you're going to be the leader of your block, you got to do the flyering. You got a flyer. For real, because you're not going to fall in love with your neighborhood unless you walk it. You know what I mean? And once you do that, people will see you out there flyering, and then you'll meet one per, oh, you know, hey, how you doing? I'm having a meeting in my backyard this month. You have to be the change for people to see it.
I definitely agree. At times, though, it's been a little frustrating for us because, let's be honest, when there's criminal activity in a neighborhood, for a lot of neighborhoods, it is a unifier, right? So people will step up. Some people will complain, but they'll share a voice in one way or another. We have participation. But then when that crime is removed, when this central focus is removed, you try to plan another event, and then you don't see the same level of participation. Mm. It's almost as if you need something negative or that type of drive in order to maintain this stream that we're achieving. But as I'm saying this, it really makes me think, something higher than that, right? Which is setting the intent for the neighborhood or perhaps a pledge. And I know I have here that the pledge of your organization, which I want to share. I pledge allegiance to the plan for the United Neighborhoods of Chicago and to the people that have taken stands, a city of many nations under God, interconnected with the equity, justice, and access to opportunity for all. What inspired this pledge and what does it mean to you?
I was in Washington, D.C., Conference for Social Cohesion. And I don't know if you guys know, but all the Uber drivers in D.C., they have master's degrees in public policy and political theory. So the Uber driver said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Chicago." And he was like, "Boy," he's like, "them people on the left side of the equation, they tough." He's like, "You know, they crashing the boards way harder than we are." And I was like, I didn't know if he was talking about basketball or if he was talking about politics. So I was like, well, maybe the people on the red team, they should do a better job boxing out. And, you know, that just pissed him off. He's like, "No." He's like, "The politicians, they need to be tougher, like the senators in Boston back in the day." He's like, "You know, if a vote didn't go their way, they'll show up at your favorite bar and they'll threaten to take your whole town off unemployment compensation." And I was like, Jeez. So this Uber driver, he was like a professor, the way he broke down these divisions mm-hmm. and political philosophies, but he talked about them like sports. So he talked about the conservative right wingers. He talked about in Atlanta, they got the New South versus the Old South. He talked about the San Francisco liberals, the Chinese collectivists, the Indian socialists, the Cuban nationalists, the Honolulu environmentalists. He had this wide range of views. And he was like, "Well, who do you think gonna win in 2020? And I was like, I don't like none of them teams. So like when I jumped into the Uber, he said I was a Chicago progressive. When I jumped out the Uber, he said I was a Democratic purist. And I thought that was funny. But the point I'm trying to make is I was like, why is there so many divisions? Like, why? Like, who's creating these divides amongst people? And this Uber driver had a bumper sticker that said, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, blah, 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 under God, blah, 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 indivisible with liberty and justice." I was like, you know what? I'm going to flip that. I was like, I pledge allegiance and set it to the flag. I was like, I pledge allegiance to the plan. I don't like all these people talking about change. Let's have a plan for that action for change. Like, I pledge allegiance to the plan for the United Neighborhoods of Chicago and to the people that have taken stands like yourself, because we're a city of many nations. Like really, Chicago is like, you can travel the world without leaving this place. Under God, interconnected with equity, justice, and access to opportunities for all, which is like breaking down segregation. So I've that's where it came from, you know. I only got, you know, that's where it came from. Yeah,
we thank Uber for it. So I grew up on the south side, Brighton Park, and at one time predominantly a Polish neighborhood. It's grown into primarily a Mexican neighborhood mm-hmm. with some Polish I think once immigrants. Of course, many of those generations have died now, unfortunately. But it's always been somewhat mixed growing up. But I did witness quite a bit of segregation. And it's hard for me, mm-hmm. someone that has traveled quite a bit. I have so much pride in my city. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I do brag about to people from other states or countries. But in the back of my mind, I can't help but to think about the segregation that I've witnessed. And it's still happening today, even 30, 40 years later. I still see it in many of the bars, the restaurants, although there are some areas that are definitely more mixed. And I do feel like we're on that right path. But it is interesting, you know, it these things that you mentioned as part of your pledge, which I do believe in, but I think a lot of people believe it's somewhat hopeless with current politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's because like race isn't even scientifically real. People need to just come out and flat out say it. It's not. It doesn't exist objectively. It only exists politically. Like it only, if you go to racially non-diverse countries, they choose other ways to separate people, you know, class, religion. In this country, we do it by race. That's just, it's unfortunate, but that's how we do it in America. It's this, you know, this European, English, early 13th century or, you know, excuse me, early 19th century eugenics word called race is so prevalent in American society in the 21st century. It's unbelievable. You know, maybe it's time that we change our perceptions. It's not real. When I go to Native American reservations and I see Native American kids growing up in poverty, they look just like the kids in Inglewood. They look just like the kids in South Shore. Their skin's a different color, but poverty, if you grow up in poverty, that concentration of poverty, it breeds a certain type of behavior. You know, when I saw kids growing up in small towns in Nebraska, they were just as isolated as the kids in Inglewood. The Inglewood kids sag their pants, their vernacular is the same. What they want to be is shaped by their neighborhood. If you grew up in 500 town in Nebraska, same way, man, you need to step outside that comfort zone and connect with people by values as opposed to the color of their skin. It's not real. And I think that Dr. King was trying to say that. And I feel like the only way you can know that, though, is if you travel. If you don't travel, you're never going to, you know, understand this. So step outside your comfort zone and start connecting with people based upon their values. That's what makes life livable, for God's sakes. It's like learning how people, different cultures do things. It's like, okay, I'm interested. I want to learn.
So on that note, your program gives young students from neighborhoods with high rates of poverty and crime a chance to visit businesses, cultural hubs, and restaurants in other parts of the city, mm-hmm. right? Places they may not explore on their own. When you introduce these experiences, how do the teens see the possibility and not the inequality?
Yeah, because they've never waited for a taxi before. They've never been in an elevator. Sometimes it's their first time seeing the lake. They've never seen a Tesla. So when they see a Tesla, like, oh, let me go take a picture in front of it. And then the guy driving a Tesla is like, this ain't a Ferrari. It's just a Tesla. But to them, it might as well be like a helicopter. So I wouldn't even call it a program. They're smart enough to see that there's a Jamba Juice in the community. They're like, how do I get that in my community? Oh, now we're talking about assets. Well, how do you think you go about getting a Jamba Juice in your community? Who would you talk to? What are the faith-based organizations in your community? What are the local elected officials? Who are the grass tops leaders? Like, what are the assets of your neighborhood? So, you know, really, they can, just like I saw life change through the Greyhound bus window, they're quick enough to see life change through the R15 passenger van window. And so they got TVs, they got Instagram, they know what plush things look like. You know, it's just that, unfortunately, man, they think that ordering their food through bulletproof glass windows is regular. They think eating McDonald's every night is regular. So when you take them to the Michael Jordan restaurant, and they get to use cutlery for the first time, you know, and not the plastic cutlery, like really like silverware. It's a fish out of water experience, and they still look for that burger. But I say, no, no burgers today. You got to try whatever's on this menu. And so mm-hmm. It's really just, that's just what we make them do. It's when you ask them what they want to be freshman year. I want to be a rapper, a basketball player. Oh, yeah, I want it to be those things too. Okay, so I'm going to expose you to 40 different jobs over 4 years. So when you get to be a senior, now you'll have a better idea of what you're interested in. Do you want to be a Microsoft engineer now? Do you want to be an electronic trader now? Do you want to work at Gatorade as a consumer engagement specialist? They never knew those jobs existed prior to being exposed to them. So, yeah, we believe exposure is key. And if you show these kids better, they do better. And I'm telling you, it works. I don't really know how. I don't really study too much about, you know, the impact of grades, GPAs, college enrollment, high school. No. We study trust, generosity, reciprocity, and confidence. Those are things that we're studying in youth. And we realize when we expose them to different things and they have to say, hey, how you doing? My name is Jamal Cole. I live in North Lawndale. That's really the first time they've ever made a public presentation. But that boosts confidence. When we get these kids volunteering on a block level, that boosts their spirit of generosity and wanting to give back, right? So these are the things that we think make positive deposits in youth. And that's how we do it.
But I'm sure for some of these teens, while it's an incredible experience, they may walk back recognizing this inequality.
Yeah.
And for some people in life, instead of using that as a catalyst for the next step, they become bogged down. It may lead to inaction or maybe a negative sense of self, even as far as like depression or insecurity. How do you make sure that it doesn't go down that path?
Yeah, I think the kids are more resilient. I think when you can come up heating the house with the oven, like you got to understand, when I take the kids downtown or take them whatever around Chicago, and when I drop them back off at night, you know, when we pull up to their houses, there might be some yellow crime scene tape. And when everybody sees it in the van, they say, oh, that's just yellow tape. That's regular stuff. It's not serious unless it's a red tape. That's when you know it's been a murder. You know what I mean? When they see each other's houses, oh, you got a fence, you rich. You know what I mean? Like, you know, so it's like these kids, if you can make it in Chicago, you can make it anywhere. They are some tough kids. They are resilient. And when they see things that are better, they say, yeah, I wanna work there. How do I work there? Well, that's kind of the light bulb. That's why we have program managers and program coordinators in the van. So once we hear a kid's interest is sparked, we try to connect them to internships or connect them to that opportunity. But it's all about mentorship and trying to catch it when it happens. I don't know when the mentorship moment's going to happen, but I'm banking on the fact that if I take you out 10 times a year, I'm banking on the fact that I'm going to find out what you're interested in. And then my goal is to go as hard as I can to connect you with that opportunity.
Oh, that's incredible. So how long are these teens in the program? It doesn't sound like it's just an isolated experience.
Nope. It's 15 kids per school and they're in the program. You know, they go 10 trips a year. They see us 20 times a year as far as volunteer activities. And they're in the program from freshman year to senior year. I mean, these schools we work with don't have after school programs. You know, there's no sports teams. There's no extracurricular activities. So a lot of times we're the only extracurricular activity. So some schools we have 30 students, some schools we have 15 students, but you're in the program for 4 years until you graduate. If you go to an option school, which only is a 24-month program, you're in a program for 2 years.
And of course, what comes to mind, you provide these positive messages, okay, throughout the year, maybe 10 to 20 times. But what we know and what we recognize are the negative messages, the models that surround these teens. How can you combat that? Because that tends to be more common, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do you make sure once you introduce these new experiences that that candle stays lit?
You know what? I don't know. What I've done is pray and try my best to be responsive. I've tried to hire people that are smarter than me at youth engagement. Because again, this is just like something I thought would work. But now I'm in a position where I can hire people that are youth development experts and they work full time, like two of them for us, and they lead the tours. And I'm able to see much more participation and engagement and development in the youth now by them reflecting on their experiences, by us taking in, you know, we take in surveys now. So we know what the kids want to do at the beginning of the year. We can see how we're moving the needle now by tracking some data. At the beginning, again, I was just operating off of the fact that I didn't know anything. And when I took the Greyhound bus trips, I was exposed and I knew some stuff. And when I went to the jail, the kids were talking just like I was, stupid at 14, 15, breaking into houses, blaming stuff on people. I said, oh, I know exactly what's going to work. Exposure, exposing you to something. So it was just that idea. I know this is going to work. It worked for me. It gave me some confidence and I'm going to run with it. So how can I prove that traveling is transformative, God? And then once you start doing it, you organically start build relationships. People start coming out the woodwork with trying to help you. Oh, we studied data at Northwestern. Oh, we studied data at UChicago. Here, take these surveys in. None of that crap worked. But the principals, wow, the principals know what works. The principals, they've been taking kids on field trips for years. They know which kids are disconnected. So they know how to cut through. So it just was me taking action and then learning from experience and then putting that experience, you know, transferring that experience to my employees. And now we're able to work with 120 kids a month.
I did see that the teens write in Explorers journals. So this is a follow-up practice to the excursions. What is the purpose of the activity? What are your expectations of it?
Yeah, it's just, I don't like surveying kids all the time like they're lab rats. The kids have program apathy. They're in so many programs. Like, take this program. Are you in this program? You're in that program? It's like so many people are studying these kids from the hood. So I wanted to get them to reflect as an Instagram post or a rap or, you know, because that's when I was at Cook County Jail. That's the only thing I did with the kids was rap. And I would notice that they would tell stories like I did as a kid, and it was therapeutic. So, yeah, basically, man, is like what we do is we have a theme, and we have all the kids write down a paragraph of that theme on the same journal. That's kind of how we're moving this year. But normally I see things like, you know, I was exposed to the treasurer of Illinois, and I asked him how much money he made. And he told me, he said, we can look up how much money he makes. They always ask people how much money they make. You know, oh, I went into a glass building today. I'd never been into a glass building before. I went to the top of the tallest building in Chicago. I'd never done that before. Yeah, I listened to what they want to be. You know, I wanted to be a rapper. Now I want to be, you know, Jamal took us to a Bears game, and I realized the guy that does the lawn at the Bears stadium is making $300,000 a year. Wow, I didn't even know that there was a career fields around the sports arenas. You know, now I can do those things. Yeah, I see their journals, and it lets me know that it's working because now they know what's possible.
Do you journal yourself?
Oh yeah, every day.
Every day. When did this practice start?
Every night at 4 a.m, I journal. Like, it's between 3:30 and 4 a.m until about 6. Maybe from four to about six, I know I'm writing. It's a habit. There's less doubt in the air in the middle of the night. I need to read and write every day and learn. So, you know, I'm listening to Marshall Ganz right now, a community organizer, this old Jewish guy, I think. He's an expert community organizer, Howard professor. I listen to his podcast and his lectures. And then I blog, you know, I write about it and I put it out on Facebook. And I just, you know, it's just something I do. I've been doing it for 10 years.
What's the toughest part about writing?
Editing. I think that, I have an editor. So, I mean, if I email somebody, I'm going to have an editor. Like, I feel like my philosophy is doing more than people expect. I'm a great writer. I tell great stories, but I don't have time to be like, punctuating and doing all kinds of like, you know, I don't waste time on that. I'm trying to get the message out. So I send it to my editor. Boom. Can you edit this for me? Oh, now I know a professional photographer. Hey, I took this photo. Can you put some graphics on it? I make sure when I put something out, it's going to like go into the world with, it's a collaborative process. You know what I mean?
And the best reflection of you.
Yes, exactly. And people see that and it's like, ooh, it's a little bit more than I expected. So yeah, I'm not the best at anything, but I'm really good at recognizing talent in others and getting them, hey, let me show you what this is going to look like when it's finished. And I need your help with this part of this boat, because when it's finished, we're going to sail over here. And so I'm like, I'm the idea person. Like, like ideas are powerful weapons to me. And I feel like to get them to the public, I want them to be received well. And that takes help.
Where do you think the future of the organization is headed? It seems to be gaining quite a bit of speed. I know I believe last year you received a grant from Mazda. Is that correct?
That was a couple of years ago, but yeah, we did receive a grant from Mazda, man. So we went from literally like nothing to having a budget of like $800,000 in like 3 years. You know what I mean? So literally, like, I feel like they say we're the fastest growing social impact org. I feel like who's, you know, compared to who, right? But, you know, I always tell my daughter, like, how you dismantle any liberal ideology as you ask, compared to what? What kind of evidence do you have, and then to what extent? But anyway, that's another story. But no, man, we're the future of my block, my hood, my city is to expand with integrity. We want to be in more schools. We work with 50 block clubs now. We train block club captains with technology. We give them laptops. We show them how to connect their block. We update block club signs. We shovel snows for volunteer. I think the future of is going to more schools, but also connecting more corporations to block level activities. Like, we're the on ramp to civic engagement in Chicago. So we want to train block club captains how to be community organizers, but also show corporations how it's their responsibility to get involved now on the block level. And I think that that's where we're going. I would like to put the program in South Africa, in Cape Town. You know, everybody's like, why don't you go to Detroit first? I'm like, man, I want to go to Cape Town, and I want to, because that's how I do. You know, I think big, and I feel like that's that inspires me. So I want to go to different cities. There's a block and a hood everywhere, and kids are isolated everywhere. And I want to change the world one block at a time.
Boy, starting this organization, it's grown so quickly. You know, how do you keep up with the expectations of you to provide more and more and more and more? And you have expanded in different ways based on the needs and some of the things that you've heard from from parents in the neighborhoods. But talking to you right now, I see the passion, the ambition, and I know within myself, it sometimes I'm the one who pushes myself the hardest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And perhaps too far. So how do you manage that if that's a challenge for you?
Like I say, man, I don't even know how to answer. I would just say that it looks better online, you know, than it does in real life. Because in real life, I can see all the people that moved away from me and how much struggle I've had to do over the last 3 years. You know, when you have to watch your wife hook up a hose in the next door neighbor's house to get water because your water is shut off. I've had to deal with that. You know, I've had to deal with my home being foreclosed. You know, I've had to deal with just so much things people don't know. So people see it as like, oh man, like you're so successful, this, that, and the third. But no, man, this is a struggle. Like this is a journey. You know what I mean? And it's like those things keep me humble. Like just me knowing, that's why I write so much. That's why I package these books up. People really think I'm rich and people think that I'm like having some great life. But no, man, I'm like, it's lonely. You know what I mean? And it's a lot of jealousy. And it's a lot, this doing good business gets you hated.
What, why is that?
I mean, they killed Jesus. You know, I mean, I feel like you think you better than us, or you getting more attention than us, or you know, they don't realize that leaders are born. Like, I don't have nothing to do with this. You know what I mean? It's like, I have a grind. I can show you exactly how I do it, but people want to cut corners. You know, they just want to believe in social media and believe in what they see on TV. I'm not made because of these awards. You know what I mean? I don't know these people that are giving me these awards. I don't even hang them up anymore. You know what I mean? All I know is that I'm lonely. This ain't even what I wanted to do with my life. This is what I was called to do. So I keep on moving forward, not because I'm getting some award. It's because I feel like this is the only thing I'm good at, is helping people. You know, I just experienced so much struggle growing up. The only thing that brings me happiness is to help people. That's all I know how to do.
Wow. Well, the city is certainly thankful for you continuing your journey, your path, even with the struggles that come along with it. And I know for a lot of people, it is very difficult to help other people when you're still trying to help yourself and your family.
Yeah, man. It's, you know, I'm learning how to be a better person. You know, I'm learning. There's a lot of things that are turbulent right now. My life is great, but it's so hectic at the same time. So hopefully, if you don't have no faith, you can't do this work. Because it's not even, how do you know the Bears are going to give you a couple $100,000 1 year? How do you know you're going to meet somebody that's, you know, the sign motivates going to give you $50,000 in a car? How do you know? You don't know nothing like that. All you know is that I got faith. I'm going to continue to pray and I'm going to continue to not fall victim to these traps of smoking weed, of doing drugs, of getting involved in drunkenness, making excuses, bad association. I'm going to stay out of them traps, because that's like, once you start doing that, man, it spoils everything that you started. You got to protect the good that you start and just understand that you're naive to think that your values aren't going to be defended. You're naive. And I've also learned that it rains on rich people. So you think it's just you going through issues. Nah, man, disappointments aren't reserved for poor people. Everybody's getting rained on in the city. That's why I read so much. That's why, you know, I'm going to listen, man. I'm going to stay moving forward. It has cost me a lot already. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I can honestly say that I've convinced myself that this is what God wants me to do. And this is what I'm going to do.
And you should definitely not stop speaking. Truly an inspiration to me. And I wonder, just thinking about my 2.5-year-old son, and I always ask this question, what specific lessons would you teach Preston?
I always teach by telling stories. So a good story to start off would be, you know, I would ask him, like, you ever heard the Bible story, whatever you sow is what you shall reap. You understand that, right? So whatever you sow, you shall reap. So if you plant spinach today, 6 weeks from now, you're not going to get any pumpkins, right? It doesn't work like that. It says if you plant spinach, 6 weeks from now, you get spinach, because whatever you reap is what you sow. I think it's another way to translate that law. Instead of saying whatever you sow is what you shall reap, you could also say whatever you reap is what you have sown. So if you don't like the conditions of the spinach that comes up 6 weeks from now, who's to blame come harvest time? person that planted it. So if you don't like the conditions of your life, come, you know, report card pick up time, who's to blame? You know, it's the person in the mirror. So I always, and I also always tell people, is, you know, you actually reap a lot more than you sow. So that's one story. I also like telling stories to youth about, there's two salesmen. One salesman looks outside, he sees it's a storm. It's raining real bad. So he says, man, it's raining real bad. With weather like this, boss can't expect me to go outside and make sales. So this salesman, he stays home. The other salesman looks outside, he saw the same storm. He said, man, it's raining real bad. With weather like this, what a great day to go outside and make sales. Everybody's going to be home, especially the salespeople. So it's your perspective on how things work out. Because some kids in Chicago, they look outside and say, man, Chicago's messed up. The gangs is messed up. The crime is messed up. The school is messed up. And they're not going to graduate. But some people are going to look outside and say, man, Chicago's messed up. The gangs is messed up. The school is messed up. And they're still going to graduate. So it's really how your perspective has a big part of how things work out. But yeah, people learn best with stories. So I'm always trying to figure out what stories can cut through and connect with youth.
Well, Preston is very lucky to have you in his city.
Cool.
And the rest of us as well.
Cool.
And I hope to work with you in some capacity, especially on the community front sometime soon. So thank you again for taking the time and sharing such a big piece of you and the organization. Mm-hmm. And of course, I just can't say enough how grateful I am to have you in our city and doing everything that you're doing. How can people still follow your story, Facebook, Instagram, your website?
You can follow us at formyblock.org. That's formyblock.org. If you want to get involved with us in the next couple months, we're going to be lighting up King Drive with holiday lights from Garfield all the way to 95th. So that's like 7 miles of lights. We're doing 250 wow. homes, 300 poles. So if you guys got lights to donate or you want to come out and volunteer, you can text message MLK Lights to 77222. That's also MLK Lights to 77222 to get involved. And then you just start organizing on your block, like start a block club on your block. Invite us. We want to help you with the flyers. We want to help you throw a party. That's what we exist for. We're a tool for people to organize. So just look us up, formyblock.org, and we're going to change things together in the city.
That's great. And you also have a book coming out.
Yeah, book coming out October 1st. It's called It's Not Regular. You'll start seeing me posted on Facebook. Just My Block, My Hood, My City at Facebook. My Block, My Hood, My City at Instagram. MBMHMC. On Twitter, but everywhere is just My Block, My Hood, My City. You'll start seeing it October 1st. The book is called It's Not Regular, How to Recognize Hidden Injustices in Society. It's a quick read, 100 pages, but it's I'm dropping jewels in this book for real.
Great. And I think people should know, although you have received grants for the organization, you primarily depend on apparel sales on your website.
For sure, man. 30% of all of our funding comes from selling t-shirts, hoodies, hats online. Support us at formyblog.org. I think if anybody wants to make a social impact in Chicago, make sure you can make money, because until you can prove or until you can do it long enough where the grants start coming in, you have to support yourself some way. You might as well make a t-shirt and use the proceeds from that t-shirt to support your impact.
Okay. Well, thanks again for your time today. Continue to push forward, and I look forward to working with you again.
Sounds good, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. If you find this podcast interesting, there are many ways you can support it. You can review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen on. You can share it on social media with your friends. You can blog about it or discuss it on your own podcast, or you can read the show notes on michaelmoodyfitness.com. Thank you for supporting the show. Listeners like you make it worthwhile.